This is Here and Now. There is a new book out today about Brett Kavanaugh, the newest Supreme Court justice, whose confirmation hearings became a bitter political fight. Sexual assault allegations against Kavanaugh and emotional testimony by Christine Blasey Ford threatened to derail the nomination, but Kavanaugh fought back.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups. This is a circus.
In the end, Kavanaugh was confirmed in the Senate by a vote of 50-48. Kavanaugh replaced the court's swing justice, Anthony Kennedy, and cemented the conservative majority on the high court. The details and drama behind the Kavanaugh nomination are laid out in Ruth Marcus's new book, Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. She's a columnist for The Washington Post and joins us from Washington. Ruth Marcus, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
President Trump famously had a list of people he said he would nominate to the Supreme Court. And originally, Brett Kavanaugh was not on that list. How did he get on that list?
So that is a great question. Brett Kavanaugh was not on three lists. Social conservatives were very wary of President Trump. Social conservatives and evangelical voters, one of their most motivating factors is the Supreme Court. So the combination of a Supreme Court vacancy and having President Trump or then candidate Trump do this unprecedented thing of telling people, okay, here are the nominees I'm going to select, and I'm going to select only from these nominees, gave them the comfort to go ahead and vote for this guy who, after all, had been a Democrat, had been married three times, was a New York liberal, etc. But Brett Kavanaugh was not on, first of all, the list that Leonard Leo, executive vice president of the Federalist Society, presented to then-candidate Trump in March of 2016. Then-candidate Trump comes out with his first list in May of 2016, no Brett Kavanaugh. He comes out with his second list in the fall of 2016, no Brett Kavanaugh. This didn't seem to be a big deal if you were Brett Kavanaugh, because it wasn't very likely, after all, that candidate Trump was going to become President Trump. But then he became president and he was elected. And Brett Kavanaugh, whose, pardon the phrase, supreme ambition had been to get on the Supreme Court for quite a while, had a problem, which was he was not on the list that the president had promised to choose from. And so a whole group of Kavanaugh allies and supporters, and he had a lot of them because he had spent a good deal of time in Washington. He had gotten incredible support for everybody from President Bush, who he had worked for, for Justice Kennedy, who he had clerked for. And people went to work on Brett Kavanaugh's behalf. Among them was Justice Kennedy, who in a private meeting with the president said, hey, there's a guy who's not on your list and he should be. And when Justice Kennedy talked, President Trump listened, because President Trump really wanted to do everything he could to encourage Justice Kennedy to step down.
So how early did Kennedy go to Trump and say, you should think about Kavanaugh on the court?
So nobody knew about this at the time, but it was at the swearing in for Justice Neil Gorsuch that Justice Kennedy asked for some time alone with the president. He made this suggestion. A few months later, lo and behold, Brett Kavanaugh ends up on a new, expanded, improved list. And the reason that it was so hard for him to get on the list was twofold. From President Trump's point of view, Brett Kavanaugh was a Bushie. He had not only worked for President George W. Bush, he had married the president's secretary. So this was not a guy that was likely to appeal to President Trump. And there was also among some conservatives some doubts about whether Justice Kavanaugh would be conservative enough for them.
But you say that Kennedy actually, when he hand-delivered his resignation or his retirement letter to President Trump, he said Kavanaugh again.
Yes. He said Kavanaugh and perhaps one other judge who had also clerked for Kennedy, Judge Kethledge. There's a little bit of disputed evidence on that. But Justice Kennedy was very, very fond of Brett Kavanaugh. He would tell his clerks, oh, this is where Brett sat. Oh, Brett worked the longest hours. And, well, like many of us, he has some ego. And the notion of being succeeded by his own favorite clerk really, really appealed to him.
But isn't Kavanaugh quite a different justice than Justice Kennedy? I mean, a lot of people think of Justice Kennedy as the famous sort of center of the court, the one who sided with the liberals in some cases, like on same-sex marriage.
Sure. Well, Justice Kennedy very famously and most importantly on issues relating to gay rights and eventually in the creation of an announcement of a constitutional right to same-sex marriage had those tendencies. He was overall, though, a quite conservative justice, even though he was at the center of this quite conservative court. But there was no way, and I think Justice Kennedy understood that, that any Republican president in the current environment was going to name another Justice Kennedy. What I talk about in the book is how the Kavanaugh nomination is really the result of 30 years of judicial nomination wars and 30 years of a learning curve by the conservative legal establishment and conservative operatives to understand we're not going to make another mistake. They got Kennedy only because they lost Judge Bork, who was nominated in 1987.
And then Borked.
And then he was Borked. Kennedy was a much more moderate person. Conservatives vowed to themselves after that that they were not going to lose another confirmation battle, and they didn't. Then after that happened, we had nominees like Justice Souter, who was nominated by George H.W. Bush, turned out to be quite a liberal justice, not the home run for conservatives that the president had promised. And the rallying cry there was no more Souters. So there was no chance when Justice Kennedy retired that we were going to get a Kennedy-like replacement. He was always going to be whoever replaced him, and this is true of Justice Kavanaugh, much more like Justice Scalia, much more like Chief Justice Rehnquist or Chief Justice Roberts than like a Kennedy figure.
We, of course, remember in Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings on the day when he had to respond to allegations from Christine Blasey Ford about sexual assault, that he went on a tirade against the accusations and railed against the Democrats and even the Clintons by name. Now, he did work under Kenneth Starr in the investigation into the Clintons. And you've got a memo or part of a memo in this book that Kavanaugh wrote to Starr in 1998 saying the president has disgraced his office. He's talking about President Clinton, the legal system and the American people by having sex with a 22-year-old intern and turning her life into a shambles. It may not be our job to impose sanctions on him, but it is our job to make his pattern of revolting behavior clear, piece by painful piece. Tell me about Kavanaugh and the Clintons and why he had such animosity towards the Clintons from that moment all the way through to the hearings to get onto the Supreme Court.
That was really both a remarkable memo, and it was a remarkable moment when he invoked the Clintons in that tirade that you were mentioning that we were all mesmerized by. And by the way, that was not an off-the-cuff remark. The day before, as he was preparing his opening statement, Judge Kavanaugh went into his chambers closeted with one clerk who had been a speechwriter and rewrote his opening statement and made it much more vitriolic, much more partisan, to the point where he came out and looked at his lawyers who were kind of liberal Democrats, the private lawyers he hired, and he said, "You're not going to like some of this." He knew what he was doing. I think that it was the Starr experience where Starr's prosecutors were in this very pitched litigation with the Clintons. There was a lot of argument about whether, obviously, the president was telling the truth and about the content of his behavior. And it wasn't just in that memo that Brett Kavanaugh expressed this hostility towards the Clintons. I tell one story in the book about going out on a blind date with somebody. This is during the Starr period. He started railing about the Clintons to her, even though he didn't know her and she was an assistant U.S. attorney. He kind of knew she was a Democrat. But he surprised his friends by the vitriol that he had towards the Clintons then, and obviously it persisted.
Let's talk about the hearings once they actually happened. Charles Grassley was the chair of the Judiciary Committee, and the ranking member was Dianne Feinstein, still is. Now, she is 86 years old now, and you make the case in this book that she was pretty unequipped to lead the effort by the Democrats to stop Kavanaugh.
Well, yes. Yeah, so what I write in the book is that the Democrats had a bad hand and they played it badly if their goal was to defeat Kavanaugh. And what I mean by the bad hand was that Obviously, they were not in the majority in the Senate. And second of all, it was in the Gorsuch hearings, the previous hearings, that Democrats had pushed Republicans to have to deploy the nuclear option so that there was no longer the possibility of a filibuster. Judge Kavanaugh only needed 50 votes to be confirmed. He didn't need 60 votes. So that's a pretty bad hand. But Dianne Feinstein, who has a impressive record as a senator, was not up to the task. She is the oldest senator, and to be blunt about it, that showed in the course of the hearings.
What did you find out about what Feinstein knew and when about Christine Blasey Ford's allegations? Because Blasey Ford had reached out to a California congresswoman, Anna Eshoo, who then reached out to Feinstein to tell her about what Blasey Ford was alleging. And then Feinstein in the hearings was accused by the Republicans of sitting on that letter until the last minute.
So Dianne Feinstein was in a very, very difficult situation when it came to Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. But what happened was Christine Ford tried to reach out to Anna Eshoo even before Brett Kavanaugh was chosen as the nominee. It took a while for her to get through. Then she spoke to Anna Eshoo. Anna Eshoo called Dianne Feinstein the next morning. Senator Feinstein said, "That's very serious. Have her write me a letter." And Christine Ford did not hear back from anybody about this for about 10 days. And in fact, Dianne Feinstein had heard this remarkable allegation against this very controversial nominee, didn't even mention it to her staff. Christine Ford was very reluctant to come forward. Dianne Feinstein felt like she needed to promise Christine Blasey Ford confidentiality. That's understandable. But I write in the book that that was a pretty major decision to make without going to any of your leadership, any of your Democratic colleagues, to just decide on your own that you're going to keep this explosive information to yourself. And especially because information like this has an incredible tendency to leak. And Dianne Feinstein did not plan accordingly for that. And that created the situation in which she was blamed, I think, very unfairly for leaking it and blamed somewhat unfairly for having sat on it. She was in a tough spot.
Well, Ford eventually, of course, did testify. And let's listen to a little bit of her today.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
That was very powerful testimony. And then later in the day, and I was there anchoring NPR's coverage for 10 hours of that day. And one of the other dramatic moments happened in the afternoon with Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, who said this during the hearings.
"You've got nothing to apologize for. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said hello, because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy. This is the most unethical sham since I've been in politics."
He's talking to Kavanaugh there. How much of a difference did that speech make?
It did. You know, it was really interesting. And to hear that again, you just are reminded of the anger and the passion of the moment. Both Brett Kavanaugh's outburst and Senator Graham's outburst, for me, they had the impact of scaring me. And I came away thinking, surely he can't be confirmed after that outburst. With Republicans, the impact was precisely the opposite. It was a rallying cry for the troops. Republicans across the country rallied for him.
Were Graham and Kavanaugh also speaking to President Trump when they did that, that this would be something that he would like because he doesn't like to give an inch on anything and would be happy for them to just keep fighting all the way?
I think they were partly speaking to President Trump, but I really think that the impact was more rally the troops and rally the senators, because the Republican senators gathered after Christine Blasey Ford's testimony and they had one of their lunches, and the assessment was Brett Kavanaugh, RIP. So they needed a push. One of the interesting stories about whether President Trump was part of their audience, actually occurred earlier in that day. The president of the United States was trying to reach Don McGahn, his counsel. Mm-hmm. Don McGahn thought, maybe correctly, maybe incorrectly, that Trump was getting ready to pull the nomination, and so he didn't want to talk to him. This is after Christine Blasey Ford's testimony. And so he's not taking phone calls from the president of the United States, to the point where his deputy reaches out to him and says, hey, the president's trying to reach you. You need to take his call. And Don McGahn told her, I don't talk to quitters.
Can you imagine denying a call from the president of the United
States? I actually cannot.
I'll call him back.
But not just one.
After the Christine Blasey Ford hearing happened, Jeff Flake, one of the moderate Republicans, got the FBI to do another investigation into allegations against Kavanaugh. But from your book and from some of the other reporting about it, it seems like that FBI investigation wasn't a real investigation.
It was not an adequate investigation. It was a dereliction of duty. And it was a dereliction of duty not just on the part of the FBI, but on the part of the Senate. The reason for that is that Don McGahn was bound and determined, as was Mitch McConnell and others, to get Brett Kavanaugh across the finish line. So the FBI investigation, which they didn't want to happen, which they only allowed to happen when Senator Flake and Senator Collins made clear that they were not going to go forward with a vote without an FBI investigation, the FBI investigation was only designed to satisfy those senators. It was not designed to get at the truth. It was designed to get to 50 votes, and it did its job in that sense. But one of the most, I thought, appalling parts of that investigation involved a man named Max Steyer. Max Steyer is the head of an organization here that is ironically dedicated to promoting good government. He's also a college classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's. He told people that he saw Brett Kavanaugh expose himself to someone, a woman, at a party at Yale their freshman year. Not the woman that you've heard about, Deborah Ramirez, who came forward in a story in The New Yorker, but a second woman. And Max Steyer was desperate to get his information to the FBI. He enlisted the help of two former federal prosecutors with good relations to the FBI. They wouldn't talk to him. He tried to reach out to Susan Collins. She says she doesn't remember that, but he was unable to get her attention. Then he reached out to Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. Senator Coons reached out to his law school classmate, Chris Wray, the head of the FBI, and said, hey, can you please interview this guy? That didn't happen. That letter was CC'd to both Senator Grassley and Senator Feinstein. They didn't say, hey, who's Max Steyer and what does he have to say that we should know about? And then finally, Senator Coons was desperate to get this information to people's attention. He reached out to Senator Flake, who he'd been working with on the FBI investigation. Senator Flake said, I can't deal with it. My family is getting death threats. I have to concentrate on that. So I just thought this was one of the most appalling derelictions of duty that I've seen in my years in Washington.
One other detail I want to ask you about. There's reporting that Ralph Blasey, who's Blasey Ford's father, wrote to Ed Kavanaugh, Brett's father, to say that he was glad that Brett was confirmed. Did that really happen?
It did really happen. Just to set the scene for you, this is the day after Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation vote. And Ed Kavanaugh, who's a member of a fancy golf club here called Burning Tree, opens his email and he finds this email from Ralph Blasey, who is a fellow member and former president of Burning Tree. And Ralph Blasey says in this email, both of our families have been through a lot. I'm glad Brett was confirmed. Now, the Blaseys, unlike the Kavanaughs, did not appear with their daughter at the hearings. Behind the scenes, they had been supportive of her. They went to see her at the hotel where she was staying after the testimony. They told her they were proud of her for speaking out and telling her truth. But that's a pretty amazing sentence from a father whose daughter had accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her.
So do you think that the Kavanaugh confirmation process is going to change the way that justices are nominated and confirmed? Has it done any lasting damage to the process?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that have done lasting damage to the process. And I would start with getting rid of the filibuster, which was a moderating influence on things. But also more broadly, I think we are just at a moment where there is almost no prospect of having somebody from the opposite party vote for a president's nominee. And that's one piece where actually Lindsey Graham was right. He was right to vote for Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. And it's truly terrible that we've fallen off that norm and there's no prospect of it being returned. I can imagine a world in which you have a Democratic president and a Republican Senate, or perhaps even the other way around, where vacancies remain open for years. And that'd be terrible.
That is Ruth Marcus, whose new book is called Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Thorough, terrific reporting. Ruth Marcus, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.